seated. Good morning. We're delighted to welcome you all to our third day of oral arguments in the February calendar. And our first case today is 12AP665, Manitowoc County versus Samuel J.H. Arguing on behalf of Samuel J.H. is Assistant State Public Defender Donald Lang. Mr. Lang, you may proceed.
May it please the court, Donald Lang appearing on behalf of the respondent appellant, Samuel J.H. Samuel is a Chapter 51 patient who was transferred from a group home in Manitowoc County across the state to an inpatient facility in Trempealeau County. There was no hearing or administrative review prior or shortly after his transfer. A month or so after the transfer, Samuel wrote a letter to the court complaining that he had been transferred without his due procedure. Counsel was appointed and pleadings were filed, and another month passed and a hearing was conducted. At issue today is whether a Chapter 51 patient who is transferred to a more restrictive inpatient placement for more than 5 days is entitled to a review hearing within 10 days of being transferred, regardless of the rationale that might be offered by authorities to justify the transfer. Appellant submits today that to give effect to the express legislative policy favoring the least restrictive placement, 5135.1e should be construed consistent with the broad pronouncement in Elizabeth M.P. to require a review hearing within 10 days anytime a Chapter 51 patient is transferred to a more restrictive placement for a period of more than 5 days. That to construe the statute as the county proposes to permit the transferring entity to thwart the right to review within 10 days simply by characterizing the reason for the transfer as something other than a rules or conditions violation compromises this legislative preference for the least restrictive placement.
Counselor, how do we get around the words that are in E2 when it says, and if the transfer is due to an alleged violation of a condition? How do we get around fulfilling that condition if we're going to do it when someone's transferred for a mental health problem, the condition that they have is getting more exacerbated? How do we deal with that?
I think the situation we're presented with is that language, to construe it, has to be construed consistent with the context of the entire statute. And the context, the entire statute, includes a clear preference stated throughout the statute and in the initial policy statement for the least restrictive placement. And that to construe it in the fashion that this county proposes subverts that interest.
A least restrictive placement is a different condition than whether you had a right to a hearing within a period of time.
Well, the right to the hearing safeguards the right to the least restrictive placement. And it's interesting in terms of how do we address this statute. In many ways, this is almost like the Teschendorf situation of how do we construe the statute and the language of the statute. Is the problem here one where the language of the statute just can't be reconciled to make sense when read in context with the purpose of the statute, which is to guarantee the least restrictive placement? Or is it a matter that to apply the statute to grant review or right to review to a very narrow group of people just leads to absurd results? However you characterize it, that's the bottom line here, is it just doesn't make sense to afford this safeguard to this very narrow group.
What I wanted to ask you is whether or not you disagree with what the trial judge, Judge Fox, and the Court of Appeals both seem to be saying, and that's that when you look at the case of Elizabeth M.P., the last paragraph especially seems to be inconsistent, that it doesn't fit together. Judge Fox said it was confusing. The Court of Appeals basically said, gee, we can't change our own precedent. We need the Supreme Court to come in and help us out in this regard. You disagree with that?
Well, I agree that the reasoning process isn't particularly tidy. The conclusion is clear, that statement. And frankly, though the reasoning isn't tidy, I think the court got it right. And that is that you're entitled to the review hearing. One of the, I see as a faulty premise underlying the state's position here is that somehow there is simply two distinct groups of people who are being transferred or subject to transfer. One is a group that is having medical issues, and secondarily, a group that has a rule violation. But when you look at the statute more closely, in effect, everybody who has a rule violation claim also has a medical component to the analysis, because the transfer cannot be justified unless it's the least restrictive placement consistent with the treatment needs of the individual. So that no matter which way you slice it in terms of the premise for the transfer, the bottom line is you're going to be addressing the medical consideration under either analysis. And to deny access to one group because of the preliminary premise for the transfer just doesn't make sense. Why should that group receive a right to review and then another group does not? Now, in terms of the temporal component of this, it makes sense to me that you would have this five-day premise or limit for those having medical issues. And in fact, the five-day limit actually furthers the policy interests in assuring placement in the least restrictive placement. Because in many instances, when people have a medical crisis, they can be brought to a hospital, provided medication, or get their medication under control and be maintained in the facility they're in currently without it being transferred at all. So we would, as a policy matter, it's something we should encourage for entities to be able to respond to an emergency crisis, maintain the patient in the location where they're at the current time without a transfer. Once you start...
Could I follow up on that?
Sure.
I understood you to say that people could be moved from one place to another in the same facility?
Well, theoretically it's possible to depending on the facility if they happen to have a hospital unit within the facility. But even if they're not, you can transfer them to a hospital unit to get their medication under control and then return back to the group home in this instance.
Well, let's go through the statute a little bit. What is the definition of transfer?
I'm not sure it's defined. My construction would be to move them from one place to another.
Well, that's exactly right. A transfer means the movement of a patient or resident between approved treatment facilities or to or from an approved treatment facility and the community. We got transfer there. But then the question is, what is an approved treatment facility? Do you know that? Well, an approved treatment facility means any publicly or privately operated treatment facility or unit thereof. Now, I think what you're arguing here, as I understand it, is that let's take a place like Winnebago. I would think that there would be multiple different units within Winnebago.
And sure. Okay. I think that's likely.
Okay.
Yes.
Transfer between approved treatment facilities, including units. You're saying that there has to be a hearing every time someone is moved within a facility from one unit to another?
No. It depends. Let me clarify. If it's going to be a transfer for more than 5 days, you need to have a review hearing. If it's a transfer for 5 days or less, you don't need a hearing. And indeed, that seems to be a very preferable policy to allow entities like a group home to send somebody, for instance, in this case, to the Nicolet Hospital. They could get Samuel under control with medication, return him back to the group home, and a hearing wouldn't be required. Once you extend that beyond 5 days, where you're not simply doing emergency intervention, then due process rights kick in and there should be a review process conducted to make sure that the transfer is one that comports with the least restrictive placement.
Okay, now, but your position is, let's say someone is transferred from one unit to another at Winnebago or Mendota or any large county healthcare center, if it's for more than 10 days, your view is that there needs to be a hearing within 10 days.
If it's more than 5 days, and if the movement is to a facility or a component of the facility that is more restrictive of liberty interests. If you're just moving to a parallel facility, then there's no right to review.
I understand. Okay. For more than 5 days, you have to have it within a 10-day period. That's your position?
That's my position, yes.
Could I ask you a little bit about 5135, that E1. When the transfer is made, what kind of information is provided to the patient?
Well, the E1 transfer provides the right to contact counsel, the right to petition the courts, and whatever is set forth in the statute for those conditions. One thing that's sort of curious here is under E1, which under the county's position would be the only remedy available for somebody transferred for a medical condition, there's really no identification of what procedures are to be applied. You're going to be having a petition to the court only if the patient has the wherewithal to contact counsel or contact the court directly, as Mr. Samuel eventually did, or somehow if he happens to have a family who's going to intervene on his behalf. But even assuming he makes that contact with the court, unlike E2, there's no procedures identified as to what the court's supposed to do with this. There's no identification of what the burden is, what the standard of proof is, what time limits apply in terms of the court even conducting a hearing, whether you can do it in 30 days or 60 days. Essentially, it's sort of an ambiguous statute in terms of any protections afforded to the patient.
Could I ask you this? I understand there's a statute, 5160, appointment of counsel, and I believe it says in any situation under this chapter in which an adult individual has a right to be represented by counsel, the individual shall be referred as soon as practicable to the state public defender, who shall appoint counsel for the individual under 977-08 without a determination of indigency. Has the practice been, when there is a transfer under E1 that we've been discussing, that the public defender is independently notified of that?
I'll tell you, this is an area that I've rarely seen in our appellate practice, that the transfer type cases, they just hasn't been something that's come to us. In my informal surveys, practice seems to vary throughout the state how this is accomplished. In some counties, they routinely inform the public defender that this is occurring. In other places, it doesn't occur. There's no obligation to inform the public defender under the statute, under E1 in particular. That's what makes the protections under the separate provisions so much better for the patient, because basically you're entitled to have this hearing, and you don't even get to waive the hearing unless you've consulted with counsel. So counsel is part and parcel of the whole review process and provides a safeguard to make sure that this transfer is justified and there's a basis for it consistent with the patient's medical condition. The E1 procedure, and again, this is just anecdotal, is sort of hit and miss. My understanding, again, this went through a prior answer, is there are a lot of situations where when they do a crisis transfer to the hospital, the problem resolves itself pretty quickly, so there's never any need for review because the person then is returned to the group home or whatever placement they're in. So it just doesn't end up being a formal transfer to another facility. Well, that's the best I can answer your question because I just don't know.
Wouldn't there be a fairly substantial increase in the workload of the public defender if under 5160 as related to 5135 E1, the public defender had to be notified every time someone was transferred to a more restrictive environment and stayed more than the requisite period of time? Wouldn't the workload go up significantly?
Well, there won't be an increase if there's no right to a hearing and there's no notification that there is a right to counsel. And that's one of the difficulties here. The entity that's making the transferring decision, whatever their motives may be, if they indicate it's a medical condition, there's no right to the hearing. The defendant or respondent is entitled to notice of a right to counsel, but the implementation of the right to counsel is a whole other thing that may not occur and will only occur if the patient initiates the process. Curiously, this group of patients who are excluded from the protections are the patients probably least capable invoking the process because they're being transferred because of their medical condition, not because of a rules violation. So this particular group in particular, I mean, Samuel had the wherewithal to send a letter, and he actually hit on target what the problem was. But he's going to be the rarity, or at least there's no guarantee that that group of patients are going to be able to fend for themselves.
Counselor, I want to shift your focus a little bit. There was a hearing held after he requested a hearing.
That's correct, yes.
And why isn't that sufficient to keep him in the commitment currently in effect after that hearing?
Well,
I understand the 10-day rule, but I'm going to set that aside. So just say I agree with you. It should have been held in 10 days. It wasn't. Instead, it was held, I think, on December 19th. Shortly after he requested it. Why isn't that hearing sufficient to guarantee that he's getting proper treatment but not inappropriate treatment?
Let me preface my answer by saying he will stay in the 51 commitment.
Yeah.
His placement will be subject to change.
Right.
So unlike the time limit violations where the guy, oh boy, we just got to cut him loose, that's not going to happen. But in terms of the series of time limit cases, and we strictly enforce those because the only way to guarantee patients their liberty interests is to enforce the time limits. To belatedly say, well, if we would have had a hearing, he would have lost anyway, doesn't protect the mass of patients' liberty interests at the time. An after-the-fact determination. I mean, if you can after-the-fact determine, then there'd be no incentive to comply with the time limits because if the patient loses in the end, you could say, well, he wouldn't have won anyway. And then if he's, unfortunately, on the other side, if he wins, he means he was denied the least restrictive placement in this case or denied his freedom unnecessarily.
And okay, so you're just saying it's absolutely unbendable rule, this 10-day time limit that you're talking about.
I think it's imperative, yes.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Now, whether or not a patient could, because they wanted to present more information, ask for a continuance, that might be something else, but we certainly don't have that here. The time limits are imperative in the 51 process. I mean, we lose sight of this sometimes. Unlike criminal cases, these people haven't committed the crime. We're providing treatment to them. And to us have the authority to restrain people, to provide them treatment, we have to guard their liberty interests particularly scrupulously. And the terminology here gets a little confusing because we talk about violating conditions of a transfer. I mean, this is like a probation case where we're punishing people. We're basically trying to ascertain what's the least restrictive placement that can be provided.
Mr. Lang, do you think there's anything wrong with the 10-day hearing, whether your client's entitled to it or not, the 10-day hearing being before a hearing officer rather than a court?
In and of itself, no. And I know in Watts, we... lifetime ago, and we were doing Chapter 55 review, The court said, well, you know, this theoretically could be an administrative hearing rather than a formal judicial hearing. And certainly, well, I just try to distinguish the probation context. In the probation context, we do administrative hearings with certain basic due process rights that attend the process. And what I'm looking for from Samuel and for similarly situated patients is to at least have the right for that administrative review to provide a check on the transferring authority to make sure that the transfer is justified factually and justified in terms of the least restrictive placement. And again, that second component applies regardless of the preliminary rationale for the transfer. I mean, one of the difficulties with the statute as proffered by the county is essentially the transferring entity can pick and choose what to call the reason for the transfer. And to the extent people have transfer conditions for their less restrictive placement, one would suspect that most of the time those conditions are going to mirror what the mental illness is. I mean, the whole point of having the conditions is to provide treatment, and the treatment and the mental health condition are kind of intertwined. So in most instances, I suspect, and certainly in Elizabeth MP, which is a good example of it, the rationale for the commitment could be called her, I think they describe mental deterioration and mental disturbance, but then they also added, well, and she wasn't taking her medicine in, as required under the conditions. So under the county's analysis, Elizabeth MP would never have gotten her hearing if the transferring agency had just left out that last sentence and they'd only referred to her the mental disturbance of the patient. One of the difficulties, as well as the transferring entity being able to pick and choose how they label the reason for the transfer, is there's no review process to determine whether that label's appropriate or not appropriate. It will only be if a patient such as Samuel happens to, you know, initiate some process to even determine whether the label's appropriate in the first place. It's also curious, I suppose, if somebody's in a group home or less restrictive placement without any formal treatment conditions ordered, that particular patient, under the county's analysis, would be completely out of luck in terms of a 10-day review because they couldn't possibly have violated any conditions because there weren't any conditions. It doesn't mean a transfer isn't necessarily appropriate based on their medical condition, but they wouldn't be entitled to the prompt review hearing to determine whether indeed a least restrictive placement is appropriate.
And the remedy here is?
The remedy here would be to order Mr. Samuel's transfer to a group home. Now, it may well be.
Is that where he was before he was transferred?
Yeah, well, it may well be that that group home doesn't have a bed anymore, but a similarly situated group home placement. I mean, this is one of the difficulties if you leave the challenge to the transfer to the patient. If it takes several months to accomplish the process, it's fairly likely the bed might be filled so that even if you do get a remedy, the remedy won't be to go back to where you were because that option may not be available any longer. I mean,
okay, then can they start these proceedings again and do
if indeed, yeah, hearing? If indeed Samuel's having difficulty and is disruptive and having mental health issues and needs to be transferred and the group home is not the least restrictive placement to meet his needs, then indeed a new procedure can be conducted, and hopefully he would get his review hearing within 10 days to screen whether that indeed is the case. This isn't a get-out-of-jail-free card for Samuel, such that he can go back and behave any way he wants or have whatever problems he wants and not have the sanction of a transfer. Poor choice of words, they're not a sanction. But a movement, if they determine that a more treatment's necessary with less liberty available to them. more restrictive placement.
Suppose they decide that he's now dangerous to himself or to others, and that the group home is not the place for him.
Then
what
they
do
could,
they do?
Then they could initiate a transfer.
Immediately.
I assume it will, to ascertain that, they're going to have some evidence or some basis to review it. But I suppose if they did an evaluation promptly, there's no requirement that he commit bad acts in order to go on. But he has to demonstrate his dangerousness in some fashion.
In inpatient placement, right?
I'm sorry?
He has been in inpatient placement, right?
Yeah, inpatient placement.
So they have records on him. They know what he's doing and what he's not doing.
I suspect they do. I hope so.
Right. So I'm saying the court orders him, if we adopt your procedures and your principles, the court orders that we remand, is what you ask for, with directions to order his return to outpatient status. Now, a lot has happened since he was initially transferred. Maybe not.
Yeah, I don't know what it is exactly.
Right.
And whether his behavior is a product of being placed back in a more restrictive placement when he felt he should have been there.
I know, but neither does the court know that.
What's that?
Neither does the court
know what's happened. No.
So, should the court be ordering where he be placed when the court doesn't have any idea of what his condition is at the moment?
Well, I think consistent with Elizabeth MP, that's the only way to protect this interest, is to put him back in the position he was in. It doesn't mean he gets to stay there, but that should be the starting point. From this point forward. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Lang. Mr. O'Rourke, Ryan O'Rourke, Manitowoc County Corporation Council, representing Manitowoc County.
May it please the court, I'm Ryan O'Rourke, Assistant Corporation Counsel for Manitowoc County, representing said county at today's hearing. The county's hope from today's proceeding, and this court's ultimate decision, is for clarification of appeals court decision in Fond du Lac County versus Elizabeth MP. As the court's well aware of at this point, this case and that case focus on 5135, Wisconsin statute, which governs transfers for people committed under Chapter 51, more specifically in these cases, transfers for people transferred to more restrictive treatment environments. The facts of Samuel's case have been discussed already. I want to focus on what Elizabeth MP says and just do a brief, quick overview of how the county saw that decision. Elizabeth MP was transferred. The appellate court made a clear decision that she was transferred for a violation of her treatment conditions. In analyzing 5130, the appellate court said that the statute offers two different procedural paths for transfers based on the reason given for that transfer. The first path is for transfers for reasonable medical and clinical judgment, patients who decompensate, medically need more restrictive treatment, medication adjustments, et cetera, et cetera. Those individuals have the right, have a certain path of rights that ends with a hearing before the circuit court judge should they request the hearing. The court went on to say that in addition to those transferred for reasonable medical and clinical judgment, if there's also violations of treatment conditions, that those individuals have the right to the 10-day administrative hearing in front of the hearing officer. If the court had stopped there with that holding, we would not be here today. Instead, the court, as Judge Fox said, and the appeals court noted, threw the net over everything. The net being that 10-day administrative hearing being required for transfers, regardless of the reason. The Elizabeth MP court did this without any explanation or reasoning as to why they were modifying the statute. That wasn't the only change that last couple paragraphs of Elizabeth MP brought about with that language. In addition, without expressly saying so, the Elizabeth MP court essentially eliminated transfers for reasonable medical and clinical judgment. They didn't say that, but that is the effect. So how do we get there? You have to analyze the statute alongside Elizabeth MP. We recognize there are two separate paths for transfers and two separate proceedings. Elizabeth MP says we have to hold the 10-day administrative hearing regardless of the reason for transfer. However, when you look at that statute, the 10-day administrative hearing requires the county to prove a violation of treatment conditions. If the transfer is not for a violation of treatment conditions, if it's for reasonable medical and clinical judgment, and we still have to hold the 10-day administrative hearing and prove a violation of treatment conditions, the effect is to eliminate transfers for any reason other than treatment condition violations. The holding essentially acts out of the statute without any explanation, transfers for reasonable medical and clinical judgment.
Mr. O'Rourke, do you think that the last paragraph of the Elizabeth MP decision is internally inconsistent?
With the logic of the body of the court?
Yes.
Yes, I do, because the court in the body of the reasoning makes a point of saying we have two different reasons why transfers can occur, and because Elizabeth MP's transfer was for a violation of treatment conditions, the 10-day hearing had to be held, only to, at the end, without explanation, throw this net over everything. And there is absolutely no justification or legal reasoning why the court would change the statute. There's no explanation that the 10-day hearing is required for due process. There's no explanation as to how you can statutorily interpret 5135 to get to the point where you believe the statute requires the hearing to be held regardless of the reason for transfer. I can only speculate as to how we ended up at this point with the Elizabeth MP decision. My guess would be that the court was careless, and I hate to say this, but was careless in its concluding language. Because otherwise there's no explanation as to why there's not a justification given.
What has Manitowoc County been doing? Have you been following the Elizabeth case or not following the Elizabeth case?
I used to work in Marathon County too, so I do that every once in a while in court. Are you asking since Samuel J.H.? Because obviously before.
After the Elizabeth case came out, have you been following it, or have you not been?
After Elizabeth MP came out, I have been assistant corp counsel in Manitowoc County by the time Samuel J.H.'s case came up for about 3 years. So I have limited knowledge onto what the county was doing beforehand. There wasn't a written policy in place, and there should have been. I handled, leading up to Samuel J.H., a couple where we did do a 10-day administrative hearing because the transfer was clearly for a violation of treatment conditions. Samuel J.H. and a case that came up slightly before it, we made the argument we made to the circuit court and didn't hold the 10-day hearing. In both cases, the circuit court agreed with us. I would say that does not follow the last couple paragraphs of Elizabeth MP. You can't reconcile those two positions. Subsequent to Samuel J.H., and not that this has any effect on Samuel's case, but procedurally what we've done as a county is it became clear to me we needed a standard written set of policies to follow. We implemented those. We are holding the hearing, regardless of the reason for transfer now, simply because I believe it's the more legally conservative approach to take to protect the transfer. That being said, I don't believe Elizabeth MP is good law, but the case says what it says. The other thing we've done, and the biggest problem with Samuel J.H.'s case that I have with how it happened, was that counsel wasn't appointed right away. And the statute doesn't require us to. The statute simply requires that we notify him of his right to counsel and provide him the contact information. But we as a county have taken it upon ourselves to, regardless of the reason for transfer, our office is notified immediately, which wasn't always happening. Probate is notified immediately, which wasn't always happening. Whether we think the hearing is necessary or not. And the public defender is notified through probate, and an attorney is appointed immediately. So that we're not having this delay that we had in Samuel's case, where it was a month and a half before he requested the hearing. Under the statute, do I think we have to do that? No. But I believe it's better procedure.
Well, Mr. Lang would tell you in his argument that that's more consistent with the spirit of what the legislature did. What do you think about that?
Mr. Lang, if we're referring to the argument where he says the spirit of the statute is to ensure the subject is treated in the least restrictive environment appropriate to his treatment needs, that is a mandate that's required regardless of whether there's going to be a court review at any level. At every stage of the proceedings, the Human Services Department has to take that into account.
That's really in the preamble of the Chapter 51 statute, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's the first wording usually out of a social worker's mouth when they're talking about where a person is placed, that they're in the least restrictive placement they need to be. Take, for example, an individual who's in Trempealeau County. His treatment providers come to the social worker, say he's improved, he no longer needs to be in a locked unit, you can transfer him. There's no hearing mechanism in place that requires a hearing or a court review at that point. It is the duty of the Human Services Department, regardless of any procedural review, to transfer the person at that point. And that's the starting point with the response to that. The other issue that I believe Samuel H.'s counsel is ignoring is the idea that the individual still has the right to a hearing. Even if it is not this 10-day administrative hearing, there's another procedural path that gets him before, the circuit court judge who handled the commitment. An argument could be made that that's a higher level of due process than a 10-day administrative hearing held before a hearing officer who, this hasn't been mentioned yet, is appointed by the treatment facility that the individual's at. It can be anybody. They don't even have to have legal training necessarily, as long as that person's not involved in the treatment of the individual. Now, the response of Samuel J.H. has been in the briefs to say that, well, yes, we have this right to a review hearing before the circuit court judge, but it doesn't happen within 10 days, and that's what we want. That's simply the way the statute lays it out. There's no way around that. Samuel's requirement under that path is that he requests the hearing. The response is that, well, he's mentally ill. He shouldn't be expected to have to request that hearing. That is inconsistent with the spirit of Chapter 51. If any argument is inconsistent with the spirit and intent of Chapter 51, that's the argument that is inconsistent. Mental illness does not equal incompetence. Chapter 51 is replete with examples where we allow people alleged to be mentally ill or found to be mentally ill to exercise their own rights and make their own decisions. Examples of the ability to release treatment records or not release treatment records. The ability to voluntarily consent to treatment without the need for a commitment. The ability to make their own decisions with regards to stipulate to commitment, enter into a 90-day settlement agreement, or whatever they want to through the court process. They even have the ability to waive counsel of their own choosing or deny treatment and medication if they don't feel it's appropriate. That right can be overcome with a court finding. But the general baseline is the assumption that someone who's mentally ill is capable of making decisions and exercising their own rights. Mental illness does not equal incompetence. So this idea that because the burden is placed on Samuel to request the hearing that somehow violates the spirit of Chapter 51, I would assert that it's the exact opposite.
Well, is that before us to declare that part invalid or unconstitutional?
No.
So what's before us, if I understand the case, is how should we interpret E, is it 3? E3.
The violation of treatment conditions.
All right. One interpretation is to have a different procedure for someone who has violated the rules than someone who has treatment issues. Sometimes they overlap, right? I would
assume.
Okay. And if thought it's your position that if it's a treatment issue, you don't need a 10-day hearing. That's my shorthand.
Right? I would use the phrase reasonable medical and clinical judgment because that's what the statute says, but same thing.
I'm trying to. Yet you're doing that. You're giving them the 10-day hearing or the possibility of a 10-day hearing.
We are now.
Is it a great undue burden on the county?
No.
You agree that, well, I shouldn't know whether you agree, but clearly there's some agreement that this statute on it, what was the terminology used by the Court of Appeals, that it's plain on its face? Plain on its face. If it's plain on its face, we should apply it unless, and there are exceptions to plain on its face, it reaches an absurd result. And that's why I asked you if there's undue problems in the county. You think Manitowoc County, as best you could tell, would be different than Marathon County when I ask whether there are undue problems?
I doubt it. The one issue we run into from a county perspective in setting up these 10-day hearings is mm-hmm. getting the facility to appoint a hearing officer. And unfortunately, it takes the control away from the county, and we're at the mercy of mm-hmm. the facility. Mm-hmm. I was actually surprised when we started setting up these hearings how many facilities. The response was, what do you mean we have to appoint someone to do the hearing? They didn't seem to understand what we were talking about. And since we use facilities in a lot of other counties, that suggests to me that some other procedures being used in other counties as well. I can't say for certain.
The hearing officer has to be someone who has no contact with the treatment of the individual. Isn't that right?
That is correct.
Does that present some difficulties in small facilities?
I would think it would. What we've... I can't imagine that some of the smaller group homes, if you have someone transferred from the community into the group home, has staff or personnel that doesn't have direct contact or treatment with the individual. What we've offered the facilities in those situations is, if you want us, we'll get you a list of lawyers who may be able to, or are willing to act as the treatment or the hearing officer, and you can appoint one of them. And that gets around the problem of someone who hasn't had contact with the individual.
Who pays the lawyers? Who pays the lawyers?
We haven't gotten to that point. I would think the county would. Since we did the transfer and it's incumbent upon us to make sure the hearing occurs, the statute doesn't say, but I doubt you're going to get a treatment facility to make that payment. It's going to fall on us.
How many such transfers do you have in a year?
Prior to Samuel J.H., it was hard to say because I don't think we had a solid policy in place where I was seeing them all.
Yes, so you didn't know them. Okay.
After Samuel J.H., in our county, these things run in cycles, but I would, if I had to offer you a number, I would say maybe 20 in a year that are to more restrictive treatment facilities and are for more than 5 days. Mm-hmm. The reality is, in doing these, every single hearing has been waived. None of those subjects who have been transferred have actually asked to have their hearing. We had a few before Samuel J.H., but every single hearing that's been brought before us that we started to set up the administrative hearing has been waived by the subject. Now, that doesn't mean they're all going to waive it, obviously, but that's the reality we've seen so far. The other argument that Samuel J.H. raises that I want to touch on before I conclude, and this is somewhat of a repetitive response from the county, but this idea that by applying the statute as written, the process is potentially subject to manipulation from the social worker or the transferring agent, government agent, whoever it may be who's initiating the transfer, that they could fudge or manipulate the reasons for transfer and not be forthright as to why transfers occurring to achieve whichever procedural path they may want. The first thing I would note with that is that the individual, well, first that is the process the statute lays out. But beyond that, the individual is still, again, entitled to a review hearing, whichever procedural path we go down. There is still a mechanism for a review to be done, either by an administrative hearing officer or the circuit court. If the reasons for the transfer have been manipulated, that's what we trust our circuit courts to be able to determine. That's why they're the fact finders. We would have a hearing on it. We have to trust in their ability to determine if that was the case. And if that was the case, the transfer will not stand.
How easy is it to get a circuit court review?
Well, Judge Fox wasn't able to, how easy is it to get? Well, I guess the first hurdle is they have to make the request. And
you've got somebody who is either institutionalized or in a group home or in some confinement is the right word, but under control of the state or the county. All right, so they have to go file papers, right, or get to a public defender.
I would say in this case they have to, at a minimum, simply write a letter like Samuel. All Samuel did was write a letter, and that triggered it.
Okay, so you write a letter to the circuit court.
Correct. You have to request a review. What that request requires, I would hope the circuit courts would be liberal in dealing with, and my experience is they would be liberal in dealing with requests, and that any letter asking for a hearing or even complaining about the transfer would trigger a review. I would hope that would be the case, and that's what I'd recommend to the judge if I was asked. But that is what would be required under that path, yes.
Okay. Then what happens?
Then the court, well, in this case, the court wrote us a letter because I think they wanted, because we don't handle these very often, wanted our input. But all the court would have to do is schedule the review hearing. Mm-hmm. It's simply a matter of getting on the court calendar.
How long did that take?
Well, in this case, I believe it took a month. It's a little longer than I would like, but that was the reality of this case.
O'Rourke, are the hearings in Manitowoc County held at the mental health facility, or are they held in circuit court?
It depends on where the individual is. For a person like Samuel J.H., who unfortunately is required to be transferred to Tremple, which is a pretty far distance, we would bring him and we would offer up a conference room in the Human Services Department to hold the hearing. If that's what the hearing officer wanted. It's ultimately, I believe, up to the person appointed by the facility to be the hearing officer where it's held. The ones that we've held, obviously they've all been waived since Samuel J.H., as I said, but the ones that we held prior were held at the Human Services Department across the street, and we brought the individual there.
If it's a review hearing by the circuit judge, is that held in the circuit courtroom?
Those would be held in the circuit courtroom.
I was thinking back to what we used to do in Brown County, where the circuit judges went to the Brown County Mental Health Center rather than the opposite, rather than having the people brought in. And have you ever had any challenges to where the circuit court holds its hearings?
Not with these hearings. We've had issues with emergency detentions where people aren't medically cleared and they're still in Nicolet, which is up in Green Bay, actually. And we would potentially possibly have to hold the hearing in Green Bay with little to no notice. That's simply the layout of the statutes.
So there's some flexibility involved as to location.
There would be. In our county, it's limited because we don't have our own treatment facility. Everybody we treat is either in Nicolet in Green Bay or Winnebago or St. Agnes in Fond du Lac or in Sheboygan. Our county does not have a facility approved for Chapter 51.
Counsel, I understood you to say that whenever there is a transfer to a more restrictive environment, your probate office now is advising what the public defender?
What happens is our human services department is directed to give notice to us of the transfer with the paperwork and probate, because probate handles the Chapter 51 filings. Probate then, they don't appoint, they simply notify the public defender's office of the transfer. Our public defender's office has been willing to appoint in every case that a transfer has occurred up to this point, and they've been very cooperative with us and working with us to find out if the hearing's going to be waived so we don't waste county resources. But that's the procedure we've been using.
Okay. If you were to prevail here on your interpretation of the statute, do you think there's any statutory obligation to see that counsel is notified, the public defender is notified, or...
I think that turns on how you interpret the use of the word refer in 5160, the statute you cited earlier. The 5135, forget the statutory section, but for reasonable medical and clinical transfers, simply says we have to notify the person of their right to counsel through the public defender, and we provide the contact information as to how to get hold of them. It doesn't say we or the court have to take any further steps. But then you also have 5160, which says, and you quoted it earlier, and I don't know the exact language, but in any proceedings under this matter, the individual should be referred to the public defender's office for representation. I would, regardless of this court's decision, recommend, not that I'll necessarily be listened to, but recommend that our registrar in probate and our public defender's office keep handling the cases the same way. That, regardless of the reason for transfer, regardless of whether we're going to appoint someone through the administrative hearing, that it be referred to the public defender's office and then leave it in their hands as to make the decision on whether someone needs to be appointed. At least notify them and make them aware of it. And then that agency is responsible for making their own decision as to whether they're statutory obligated to appoint counsel. I'm sorry.
Wouldn't it be a little troublesome, now in your case, Samuel J.H., I think it is, was transferred to Trempealeau County from Manitowoc. Wouldn't it be a little troublesome if no one other than Samuel was notified of that transfer?
I agree, and that's why we changed our procedures. In Samuel's case, I wasn't notified either. The Corporation Counsel's office wasn't notified. I think it is definitely better practice that when the transfer occurs, even though I guess I'll preface this with the idea that I'll argue that the statutory requirements were still met. There's nothing in that section of the transfer statute that says probate needs to be notified or public defender's office needs to be notified or even that corporation counsel's office needs to be notified. It simply says that Samuel has to be given his rights and it's incumbent upon him to then exercise or carry them out. Is it better practice to have those other entities notified and involved right away? Absolutely. And we'll continue to do that. Is it statutorily required? I don't believe it is.
Well, what do they do with a family? I mean, I don't know anything about Samuel J.H., but other people, or maybe Samuel J.H.'s family who visits him once a week, once a month, once every 2 months. What do they do? Show up and find out that Mr. Samuel J.H. has been removed?
My experience would be that Samuel is able to exercise various rights even with the transfer to Trempealeau, and that the facility, I've never seen a facility not work with an individual to keep them in contact with family members so that they know where he is. But as far as our ability to notify a family member, they're confidential proceedings. I don't think we can take any steps as a court system to notify them.
I was just wondering if the facility notifies them.
I don't know. I think the facility would assist Samuel in contacting them and notifying them, that at a bare minimum. Whether the facility takes it upon themselves to notify, My guess is that's tied up in HIPAA rules and confidentiality issues, mm-hmm. and I wouldn't even begin to try and address that okay. here because I don't know.
I can understand that reluctance, counsel. I'm sorry I asked the question.
It's okay. I'm sorry I can't answer. Ultimately, if there are no more questions, regardless of this court's decision as to whether Samuel J. H.'s transfer stands or not, our main hope from this proceeding is that you take this opportunity to clarify Elizabeth M.P.
Well, assume that the court says this was not done properly, what remedy do you think the court should provide?
I believe Samuel would, I agree with counsel, I believe Samuel would have to be transferred back to a group home setting or less restrictive.
Okay, thank you.
I thought I wrote down that you said that the administrative hearings you did not view as a great burden on the county. Now, Manitowoc County is an outstanding county. Do you think it would be a burden on any counties?
I think it could be. And I guess it all depends on how you define burden. Any hearing we provide requires setting it up, using resources, getting a court reporter there, having to pay for that, getting witnesses there, using up resources that are valuable. But do I view it as a burden that I guess when I say it's not a great burden, it is something we can handle if we're told that's what we're supposed to be doing.
Doing it anyway, even if not told.
We have been. Just simply because of the last couple paragraphs of Elizabeth M.P., even if I don't agree with them, they do say what they say. So it's been a better approach to at least start to hold the hearings. And like I said, they've all been waived. So I guess when I'm answering the question as to whether they'd be a huge burden, it's hard to answer because we haven't had to hold any. Given that they've all been waived at this point, that could change, though. And we could go through a run of 5-10 people who don't waive the hearing. And then it will eat up resources and money and time that can be spent elsewhere.
If you don't have the hearing, then if the person wants to, they go to circuit court, which may be a little more burdensome.
I actually think the circuit court review is less burdensome on the county.
Oh, good. Why?
We don't have to appoint an administrative hearing officer. The court reporter is already there. My fear with the administrative hearing officers is that they usually don't know what. They don't know the rules of evidence. They don't know what standards they're supposed to be applying. You already have a judge trained on the bench, familiar with Chapter 51 cases, mm-hmm. familiar with this specific case, there and ready to make the decision. The hearing might not be able to happen quite as quickly, but it's certainly less of a burden upon the county. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Mr. Lang?
Just a few very brief remarks. There was a reference to judicial review being a remedy that was still available to patients who are having clinical issues. And again, our contention is the if and when problem, that we don't know if it's going to happen and when it will happen, could be a long period down the road. The guarantee of a timely review hearing for any person transferred is the only really way to safeguard the patient's interests. There's no reason to distinguish this group of clinically troubled people from those who have a rule violation. I think counsel's correct that mental illness does not automatically mean incompetence, but it's surely a pretty good indicator that it's likely to be there. And to assume that people are suffering from a mental illness, particularly when that's the reason being offered for their transfer, are going to be capable of unilaterally implementing the judicial system is, I think, unrealistic. One last point, Justice Crooks was talking about the hearing examiner and the fact that this person isn't involved in treatment. I think almost more importantly, this hearing examiner is from the institution that receives the patient, not the institution that is transferring the patient. And something that's easy to get lost in all this is the group homes and various entities that house these individuals are not public institutions. They are contracted private entities that have a profit incentive involved here. And while there's nothing necessarily wrong with the profit incentive, it can create a conflict of interest. A patient who's troublesome and annoys other patients, who may be there not on a commitment but on a private insurance basis, may drive a patient to some other institution. A patient that requires more resources to take care of cuts into the profits because it may require more employees to take care of them. A patient that's just a pain and people don't like being around may provide an incentive for the sake of employees just to move them on. There's a multitude of reasons, whether it's the level of compensation a particular patient brings in or whether the patient drives out or costs more just to take care of, that can influence the transfer decision. So having a hearing examiner from another entity who's independent of the transferring entity to provide the check in a prompt fashion safeguards the patient's right to the least restrictive placement.
Do I understand what you're just saying is you thought the hearing in this case should, well, the hearing in your view should have been in Trapelo County. Is that right?
I don't think it really matters where it is as long as it's within 10 days. I mean, the facility or the physical location where it occurs, I don't think is important. What's important is having the independent entity do the review process. I mean, ideally, I suspect we'd all prefer to have a court do it just because of familiarity with the process. But I think the perception was that that would be burdensome on the courts to do it, and having a hearing examiner do it at a location where the patient is might be more efficient. The important part from my perspective is having the independent reviewer do the examination. And so basically our position then is that since the hearing wasn't done within 10 days of Samuel's transfer, that he should be ordered returned to an outpatient placement. And again, that placement at the Newport home may not be available anymore, but a similarly available group home of a similar security level should be appropriate. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. I want to, on behalf of the court, thank Mr. Lang and Mr. O'Rourke for their arguments relating to person who is competent at least for some purposes and is under care. We have two cases today involved in mental health issues. They are always troublesome, and we appreciate the work of counsel. That ends the hearing in 12 AP-665. Manitowoc County versus Samuel J. H. We have students coming in from Newman, who are both excused, from Newman Catholic High School. Do we need to take a recess or can we proceed? Okay, we'll take a recess.